Welcome to Gospel Truth with Andrew Womack. Today, Andrew explores America's godly heritage with special guest David Barton. And now, here's Andrew.
Welcome to our Thursday's edition of the Gospel Truth broadcast. And today we have another special program with our guest, David Barton. He's the president and founder of Wall Builders Ministries. And we've had him on. Tomorrow is going to be the end of our second week, and it's going to be the end of this series. And I tell you, David, it's gone quick for me. I've got a lot of... We've been talking in between tapings and during lunch. And I tell you, this guy, he's just like the Energizer Bunny. He never runs out. And he's shown me some things. I wished we had more time to be able to cover even more, but I am really excited about what has happened, and it's inspired me, and I know it's helped our people that have been watching this. We've been talking about the influence of God in our government and how our government was started as a product of revival and religion. Our faith in God, morality, biblical morality, has always been a part of government until recently. And what we are seeing, the secular humanism of our governments, not only here in the U.S., but around the world, is the anomaly. Mm-hmm. This is not normal, and we're trying to call people back to it. And so we've been talking about this. How did it happen? We talked about that the church used to be very vocal and very active, presenting biblical truths in the public arena, making comments on politicians, on government policies, and stuff. The church backed off. In that vacuum, we've had our education rewrite history and either omit things. Like, for instance, I remember in your DVD series you were talking about if they would have had the brief history of every signer of the Declaration as it was done for how long was that?
It's generations. We had that in public schools.
And so that was every child that went through school knew a brief history.
Yes.
And they were 95% outspoken Christian, most of them ministers. If they would have just known that one piece of information, that would have stopped a tremendous amount of the lies and deception that are going on. And so anyway, our education has omitted that and then turned around and done things like that book, The Godless Constitution, which is a total travesty on truth. And because of this, we've raised a generation of people that don't know the truth and therefore aren't free. Again, what was the quote by Abraham Lincoln?
Abraham Lincoln, the philosophy of the schoolroom in one generation will be the philosophy of government in the next.
And that is exactly what's happened. In the, what was it, the 20s, they began probably right after the Second World War is when our education began to really go against the
The philosophy started changing in the 1920s with Dewey and a bunch of guys because they came in with a real secular form. Then we went to compulsory education, so we're going to force you to get a secular education. They also philosophically changed the way we taught schools because prior to 1920, we always believed that God wanted you to use your mind, and that's the scriptures in Matthew 10:16, so many others. And so up to then, we always taught students how to think. That was the key thing, was how do you think? And so Isaac Watts, a great theologian, the book we used in America for generations, century and a half, two centuries, was the right use of the mind, the improvement of the mind. And it's teaching you how to think the right way. And so in the 1920s, we got away from that and said, no, we don't need to teach kids how to think anymore. We need to teach them how to learn. And so therefore, we, the teacher, will impart to them what they need to know and we'll be the filters to choose what they should know. And so to get them to spit it back at us, what we're going to do is we're no longer going to do essay questions on tests or forensics. We're now going to do true, false, multiple choice, and fill in the blank. And we'll teach them stuff, and we'll teach them to spit it back to us. And so our whole philosophy was now we're going to dump stuff into you, and we want you to spit it back at us, which is one of the reasons America's become so gullible. Oh, I heard that on the news. I saw that on the Internet.
Yeah.
You know, we're used to just receiving and spitting it back out and not analyzing and thinking, no, wait a minute, that can't actually be. I mean, how can you have a godless constitution when 95% of the guys who wrote it were the, but we don't think. And so that 1920s, we started shifting the philosophy of education. Then right after World War II, we started shifting the textbooks, and we stopped talking about faith. We stopped talking about morality. We stopped talking about those traditional value type of things that are biblically grounded, and we just started making the whole history look secular. Well, if you grow up thinking, I live in a great nation and we have a secular history, then your logical premise is, let's stay a great nation. Let's keep it secular. And that's really where we got off
track. Instead of teaching you how to think, they taught you what to think.
What to think. That's exactly it.
And they basically indoctrinated you. And this led to, you made a comment while we were having lunch today about how that you have law schools that have gone to great effort to try and discredit you mm-hmm. because the law schools have now been taught this new version of everything,
yeah.
and they have totally ignored history, and so therefore we've produced a group of activist
That's
judges
right.
that are actually rewriting the Constitution.
See, I'm a great problem for law schools because I keep going back to original documents, and they don't want to do that. They want an evolving Constitution. We've evolved. We're 200 years more advanced than they. We don't want. And so what I'll say is, on the law school website, it says that federal judges are appointed for life. Article 3, Section 1 of the Constitution says they're not appointed for life. Well, that makes the law school look bad to actually go to the Constitution and say they're wrong. You know, the law schools on their websites will say the judiciary is an independent branch. It's one of three co-equal branches. Well, I'll go to the Federalist Papers and say, no, the judiciary is specifically the weakest branch. It is not co-equal. It is under the regulation of the other two.
Now, see, if I hadn't have listened to you and heard you quote those things on that thing and present that little document, I would have thought, well, that's against everything I've been taught.
And
I thought it was three equal branches.
It's against everything you've been taught. But it's not factually right.
It's not against the Constitution.
It's not against the Constitution. The Constitution is very emphatic. Judiciary is the unelected branch. Therefore, they have to be the weakest branch, and they have to be the one under the control of the other two. That's why judges can't appoint themselves to office. They have to be appointed by somebody who is elected. Judges can't set their own salaries. The people who are elected have to set salaries. Judges can't even determine what all cases are going to take. The people who are elected determine what cases.
So just in the same way that the president and the Congress is accountable to the people, the judiciary should be accountable to the people, but that's not what we see today.
What we see today is that they have convinced us that they're supposed to be unaccountable to the people. Otherwise, how can they be independent? Thomas Jefferson had a great quote. He said, whatever body is independent is also absolute. If you can't get to them to help control them, then there is no accountability. And so what we have is an unaccountable judiciary. So if they go through, as they did in a case a few years ago, the Congress, and I helped the Congress, and we worked on a law, we actually quoted the Constitution in telling the court what it could not do. We said, no way, you cannot deal with this, and this is the specific clause of the Constitution. And the court pops up and says, well, that's unconstitutional. You can't tell us what we can and can't do. Wait a minute. We quoted the Constitution to tell you what you could do. So what happens is
Who won that battle?
Well, they did. Because
the court
won. Because the only way you can get rid of them is you have to do what the Constitution authorizes in six places, and that's take them off the court. But to take them off the court, you have to have the support of the people. And the people all think, you can't tell the court what to do. They're an independent branch. We've been taught this for so long. And what we found was in Congress, even though Congress is willing to restrain activist judges, the people weren't willing to back them up on it because the people didn't know they should be
restrained.
So they
don't have the support of the people. And without that, the Congress won't move because they're afraid of being re-elected.
Congress can't get much out in front of the people. Congress has got to figure out where the people's going to get in front of them, but it can't lead the people. And so that's why if Congress tries to lead in a direction different from the people, that's when you get new Congresses, because people say, we don't want to go there.
Well, would to God we could get a new Supreme Court.
Well, and that is the key, because that's what the debate has been for the last several presidential elections over what they call strict construction or originalist versus the living document people. The strict constructionist says, look, according to the original documents, we in the court are the weakest branch, and we're not supposed to make policy. So our deal is we defer to Congress and the president. We won't make policy. Now, if you get guys on the court like that, they're not going to be activists. If you get a living Constitution guy on the court, he says, we're supposed to rewrite the Constitution from decision to decision. It's an evolving document. It's in our hands. And therefore, here's what we want to do. And those are the guys that keep pushing the envelope. And what's amazing, I had a little debate once with a professor at the University of Iowa, and it was about separation church and state and religion in America, whatever. And he was a living constitution guy, and I'm a strict construction guy. You keep it with the original intent until the people amend the Constitution. And so when my presentation is over, he said, I'll admit the founding fathers did not want a secular public square. The founding fathers wanted religion. They didn't want separation church and state like we've got. They didn't want it. He said, but my point is this. I don't care what they wanted. I think the Constitution should reflect what we want today.
Oh, man.
And so I acted, at that point I had him. He didn't know it, but I had him. And I acted really surprised. I said, you're kidding. You think the Constitution should reflect the values of people today? He said, that's exactly what I think. I said, I'm so glad to hear you say that, because 82% of the people want daily prayer in public schools. 76% of the people want the Ten Commandments posted.
That's
75%
excellent.
Of the people, they want faith-based programs. 72% of the people want marriage between. And I went through all these things. He said, whoa, whoa, whoa. He said, you got separation church and state? I said, time out. You just told me that didn't matter. See, the problem with a...
Yeah, it's hypocritical.
It is. And the problem with a living constitution person is what they really want is they want a group of just a handful of people to tell everybody else what to believe.
Yeah.
I don't care if the Constitution evolves as long as we're the ones that do it. That's why we've added 27 amendments to the Constitution. You know, we wanted... the Constitution didn't let 18-year-olds vote. We amended that.
Okay, so some people that would be taking exception with what you're saying would be saying, but... wait a minute. This has never been done. The court has always ruled. Is there precedent?
There is precedent
of us overriding and going against.
Absolutely,
the
all the time on a regular basis. As a matter of fact, you find that Thomas Jefferson ignored decisions of the Supreme Court, as did James Madison, as did Abraham Lincoln, as did Andrew Jackson, as did a number of people. Just they ignored the court because it was one of three branches.
And of course, let me just point out that Abraham Lincoln is one of the obvious ones. That the Dred Scott case was not very long before Lincoln took office, and it basically said that a black slave was property and not a human individual.
This is the original Dred Scott decision from the Supreme Court right there. That's one of the worst decisions in judiciary history of the United States. This decision said that Dred Scott and blacks, one of the famous quotes out of here is, no black has any right which a white man is bound to respect.
Wow.
So that is one of the famous quotes. This said Congress cannot in any way limit slavery in any territory, in any state. Slaves cannot be freed because they are property, and went through all this stuff. And so Abraham Lincoln said, watch this. He then abolished slavery in the territories. He abolished slavery in Washington, D.C. He freed slaves in the Emancipation Proclamation, all the things that the court told him he could not do.
He
just went through and promptly did it. And his first inaugural address, he said, now, if I'm going to obey the Supreme Court, why do we have a president? Why do we have an election? Just let them run everything. He says, I didn't take an oath to uphold the opinion of the Supreme Court. I took an oath to uphold the Constitution of the United States. And the Constitution definitely gives Congress the power to limit slavery in the territories and D.C., and that's what he did. He went through.
Well, you know, in our day today, it's the 200th anniversary of his birthday, and people are referring to him and making speeches, quoting him and stuff, and yet doing things completely opposite
to what
of what he's saying right there.
That's right. And this is where having an understanding helps us, because a verse we talked about last week is Isaiah 126, where the Scripture says, I'll give you judges as at the beginning and lawyers as at the first. And he says, if I do that, you'll be a nation of righteousness. And I just find it, again, profound that God ties the righteousness of a nation to the type of judges you have in that nation. So it becomes incumbent on me to choose presidents and to choose senators who will give me the right kind of judges. You know, I shouldn't care what their economic policy is going to be. I shouldn't care what their moral policy is going to be. I should care, what are you going to give me for judges? Because that is the one thing the Word of God tells us will affect our righteousness, is the kind of judges we have. So when I look at a president, my first question should be not what are you going to do with the economy, not what are you going to do with the war, not what are you going to do with education. It ought to be what are you going to do with judges. And if you don't give me judges that give righteousness, then we're in trouble. My first question for a senator shouldn't be, what are you going to do with the economy? What are you going to do with the, it ought to be, what kind of judges are you going to confirm? And that's biblical basis. Now, having said that, the fun part is, what does it mean, judges at the beginning and lawyers as at the first? Let me take an example. This is a book written by one of our very first federal judges in America. His name is Francis Hopkinson. Francis Hopkinson is the guy who actually designed the American flag. He was a signer of the Declaration of Independence. But Francis Hopkinson is also a church music director and a choir leader. And what this book is, 1767, it's the entire book of Psalms set to music. This is the first time in America that we had a purely American hymn book. So here you have a federal judge who set the entire book of Psalms to music. And I've always wondered, how long would it take you to sing the book of Psalms if you were in a church? The book of Psalms, the hymn here is 62 pages long just for Psalms 119. So if you had Psalms 119, has seen. So this is what a judge was like at the beginning. The Word of God is the base of what they did. This is another example. This is the U.S. Supreme Court. This is 1792. The guys on the court were put there by George Washington. Three of them signed the Constitution, two of them ratified the Constitution, and one of them wrote the Federalist Papers. They would not. They had jury trials then in the Supreme Court. They would not let a jury go out to deliberate until they first had a preacher come in and pray over the jury that the jury would get the mind of God. Because they believed out of 2 Chronicles 6 that they were supposed to rule in the place of God. And how could you have justice on earth if you didn't get a hold of the great judge of the universe? So we didn't let a jury go out until we had prayer over a jury that it would get the mind of God. And that's what our judges did. We have, you know, so many examples of that. And we were talking even yesterday some of the black history. What's really cool is in America, back in this era, we had both black judges and white judges.
Yeah, now this was something I was going to mention, that people who would be critical of your stance that the judiciary is the least powerful of the three, they would cite, well, it was the Supreme Court that basically brought the end to segregation and overcame Congress and things like that. Yeah. Is that accurate?
Let's take this. If it were up to the Supreme Court, blacks would still be slaves. That's right. Congress who said, we're in slavery, watch us. It was the president who said, we're in slavery, watch us. Supreme Court, get out of our way. As a result of what Abraham Lincoln did and Congress passing the 13th Amendment in 1865, the 14th Amendment in 1868, and the 15th Amendment in 1870, we were able to elect blacks in the federal Congress. The first blacks elected in Congress were just wonderful guys. You had Josiah Walls, you had Hiram Revels, you had Joseph Hayne Rainey, you had Robert Brown Elliott, all these great guys
in
Congress.
Now, is that the first time blacks had ever been in
the federal Congress?
Mm-hmm.
Now, they had been elsewhere in states, but in the federal level, the first time they had been, and they promptly joined with white Christians, black Christians, white Christians joined together. They passed 23 civil rights bills. Now, blacks in Congress were still in a minority, but they're in Congress. And that's a result of ignoring the Supreme Court.
And that's back in the late
1800s. That was 1870 that they were elected. As a result of what happened with the 14th Amendment, you could start electing blacks into southern state legislatures. Now, they could be elected northern state legislatures way back 200 years earlier. But in southern state legislatures where they had slavery, by state law, they said you can't be a black and hold office. The 14th Amendment, the federal constitution, says now you can. We don't have slavery anymore, and so you can't hold office. So promptly in Texas, 41 blacks were elected to office. In South Carolina, 190 blacks were elected to office. State legislature, 112 in Mississippi, 99 in Alabama, 137.
Now that's in the 18...
This is all 1870, 1872. They're in that range.
You know, that's just amazing to me.
It just...
You wouldn't... I personally, based on my experience, I wouldn't have thought that anything like that happened until the 60s or something.
No, they all, you know, probably shocked people today, every single one of them was a Republican. Because it was the Democrat South who had slavery. It was the Democrats who fought Lincoln to keep slavery. When we voted on the 14th and 15th Amendments, not a single Democrat in Congress voted for either of those amendments, for voting rights for blacks or civil rights for blacks. So every black that held office was a Republican at that point in time. So what happens is now you've got the blacks and the whites in Congress side by side. They passed 23 civil rights laws, and one of the really cool laws they passed in 1875, Congress banned segregation straight out. We're not going to have segregation in housing, in transportation, in dining. We will not have segregation. Congress banned segregation.
Oh, now that's radical.
Especially back then.
I remember in my day.
Segregation.
When there was segregation.
Now, what
in
changed,
the 50s and 60s.
That's right. What changed segregation was the Supreme Court in 1954 in the case called Brown versus Board of Education. The Supreme Court said, we're ending segregation in education. We're going to put this one in. And people say, well, see, that proves the Supreme Court did the right thing. I got to go. Time out.
Yeah.
Let's go back to 1875. 1875, Congress banned segregation. In 1882,
over the objections, I'm sure, of the Supreme Court.
Well, 1882, the Supreme Court struck down the law of Congress and said, you can't end segregation. We want segregation. The Supreme Court is what kept segregation alive for the next 70 years.
Wow.
Congress ended it in 1875.
So they finally, in the 60s, is when they finally
gave in
to the will of the people back in the 1870s.
See, that's why the judiciary is such a problem, because if you have the wrong judges on there and they start making policy, they're usually out of touch with the will of the people. And that's why you elect your legislators, you elect your president, but your judges, you don't let them make policy. They're out of touch with the people.
Well, David, if people understood this, it would be so obvious as why we've had the racial tensions and things like this. Because even back in the 1700s, there were, I heard you say that Boston had desegregated.
Let me give you some just interesting facts. I have a lot of fun with this. 1768, a guy named Wentworth Cheswell, a black, is elected to office in New Hampshire. He's elected first as a town father in his town. He is elected to the school board. He is elected as a city assayer, the city assessor. He is elected as a town moderator. He is elected as the town judge. He is elected to the Constitutional Convention to write the Constitution. But wait a minute, he's a black back in the 1700s. They don't do that back. Yeah, they did. You see, in that New England area, they had taken the Bible base and the Bible taught in Acts 17 and in Revelation 7 that all men were equal. And so we had blacks elected to office way back in the 1700s. And what's really funny is we hear about the midnight ride of Paul Revere. You know, Paul Revere going to warn the Patriots. Riding with him that night was a black patriot, a black and a white patriot.
So
the black patriot was Wentworth Cheswell. The white patriot was Paul Revere. Now, Paul Revere ends up getting word to a church out here at Lexington, and that's where the shot heard around the world was. Lexington, you have the first battle of the Revolution. What happened was Jonas Clark was the preacher. He got his church out there to face the British, 150. And after the battle was over that morning, there were 18 Americans laying on the ground. Those 18 Americans laying on the ground were both black and white. They all went to church together. You had blacks like Prince Esterbrook and whites like John Robbins laying on the ground that day after the battle was over.
I tell you, David, I've been taught basically that the oppression of the blacks and slavery and all of this has been since the founding, that was even a part of it. Of course, we're out of time. I hate this, but the three-fifths clause, you explained that so wonderfully.
It is totally different
not
what we're talking.
Actually, you said something to me that I think it was, what, only one-third of the nation when we signed the Declaration was pro-slavery, but they...
Of the founding fathers, about 70% of the founders were anti-slavery. About 30% were pro-slavery. And to this day, we will always hear about the pro-slavery founding fathers. We'll never hear the abolitionist guys. We'll never hear up in New England. The hero of the Battle of Yorktown was a black patriot, James Armistead. The hero of the Battle of Bunker Hill was a black patriot, Peter Salem. We'll never hear that. What we're going to hear is the oppression, and it did happen, but we'll never get that.
And we aren't trying to say that it didn't happen, but
it did happen.
There was a freedom movement that was based in the Bible.
In the Bible.
And actually, the Supreme Court was
got in the way of it.
A hindrance of it for probably 100 years, close to 100 years, or we would have been desegregated as a nation.
We wouldn't have had the stuff that we had in the late 1800s and the early 1900s if the Supreme Court had gotten out of the way, which is why it's so important the kind of judges you have on
the court. And today we see the Supreme Court, I believe, legislating from the bar and causing most of our, or I could say many of our social ills today. Mm-hmm. Well, we're running out of time again. I tell you what, it seems like there isn't enough time to do this. But this is powerful, and this is one more reason why I really want you to get this series. Again, this is because the truth will set you free. We need to know these things. It'll change your impression about things, and it'll also give you a new boldness to be able to be in the marketplace talking about these things. And also, it'll give you a lot of ammunition, a lot of defense for the truth. And I tell you, I believe that if people were to get this, not only in the United States, but around the world, it would make a tremendous difference in the way we exercise our influence for the Lord and for the truth. So I encourage you to please get this. There's 26, what do you call them in here, lessons or 26 30-minute segments on the things that we've talked about. And of course, it goes into much more detail. As David has been talking about this, you know, I've watched about 10 of these. And I'm thinking of all kinds of things that I saw that we just don't have the ability to bring you right here on this program. So please get this series. It'll be a blessing to you. We have a number and address on your screen. You can also go to our website or David Barton's website. We have all of that information available. So please take advantage of it and make sure and join us again tomorrow as we conclude these special programs on the Gospel Truth.
Today's discussion between Andrew and David Barton, titled God and Country, is available in a two-part DVD album as seen on TV. This program, in which Andrew and David discuss America's moral, religious, and constitutional heritage, will be a valuable addition to your personal DVD collection. It's available for a gift of $15 or more. Request DVD album T3505D when you contact us. The second DVD, titled God and Country Part 2, is available for a gift of any amount. We encourage everyone to give, But if you're simply unable to afford it, Andrew and his partners will provide this second DVD free of charge. Request DVD T3505-D2 when you write or call, and we'll be pleased to send it to you. We're also making David Barton's DVD set titled The American Heritage Series available to you. You can have this informative and educational 10-DVD set for a gift of $80 or more. Request item TM233D when you contact us.
Again, I would like to just stress that the materials that we are talking about are in this series right here, the American Heritage Series, and this is by David Barton. There's 26 half-hour segments in here, and I've watched, I think, 10 of these, and I tell you, they are powerful. I have learned more concerning the godly heritage of America through watching this than I've learned in my 60 years just learning things on my own. It is tremendous. It'll help you. David has shared the cost of this. He's cut his price to us by 50%. So as you give and get this series, it'll be going towards David. Also to help us with these programs, I encourage you to get this series today.
You can use your credit card to order by telephone. Our helpline number is 719-635-1111. Helpline hours are from 4 a.m. until 9:30 p.m. Mountain Time. Again, that number is 719-635-1111. Or you can reach us through our website, where you can order ministry materials online 24 hours a day, 7 days a week at awmi.net. If you prefer to write to us, our address is Andrew Womack Ministries, P.O. Box 3333, Colorado Springs, 80934. Your gifts help Andrew bring the almost too good to be true news of the gospel into countless homes every day. We appreciate your generosity. We hope to hear from you today. We'd like to point out Andrew's upcoming speaking schedule. He'll be in Durant, Oklahoma, July 30th and 31st, in Boston, Massachusetts, for a Gospel Truth Seminar, August 6th through the 8th, and in Little Rock, Arkansas, August 28th through the 30th. He'll also be in Charlotte, North Carolina, September 13th through the 18th, in Johnson City, Tennessee, September 19th and 20th, and in Colorado Springs, Colorado, for the annual Andrew Womack Ministries Ministers Conference, September 28th through October 2nd. For more details on Andrew's next meeting in your area, call our helpline or visit our website at awmi.net.
And you get this thing because that's what you see on TV. They'll pick secular guys from both houses, and that's what you'll see. I will tell you right now that on any given Tuesday or Wednesday in the U.S. Congress, we have 120 members of Congress and one of four Bible studies going on in Congress. Bible studies and prayer meetings, and I will tell you even more than that, they have accountability groups. One of our former congressmen, Steve Largent, great guy, out of Oklahoma, pro football player. Steve, I remember talking to him and talking to some other members of Congress. He started little accountability groups. And I remember talking to one of the guys in the groups, and there was an accountability group of like four guys. And there'd be four guys in these groups. And they'd get together, and this would be the questions they'd ask. I said, you know, I saw how you voted today on the bill, and you're going to explain to me, you're going to have to explain to me out of the Bible why you voted that way, because I don't see a biblical reason for you to vote the way you did. Now, I don't think most of us would want to be called on the carpet like that.